Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, a series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, the state of California, and their home and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. Our guest this morning is Professor Dean McCannell, he's a professor of environmental design at the University of California, Davis. Professor McCannell was educated at the University of California and at Cornell. His teaching, in addition to UC Davis, includes UC Irvine, Cornell, Rutgers, Temple. He taught at the Haverford Center, College Center for Peace Research, and at the American College in Paris. He's the recipient of many awards for teaching and scholarship, and his book, The Tourist, is a classic, first published in 1976, I think, if I'm right. It's never been out of print. His newest book is The Ethics of Sightseeing. Perhaps we'll get a chance to talk about that a bit later. He's also author of Empty Meeting Grounds, 1992 edition, and The Time of the Sign, 1982. Good morning, Dean.
Good morning, Cal.
Good to have you with us this spring morning. Dean, let me begin with this. I think the last time you spoke to us up here in Mendocino County was on the occasion of a conference hosted by the Mendocino Institute on the topic of affordable housing. Well, we didn't get any affordable housing, I'm very sad to say.
Sorry to hear that, yes.
Yeah, but we did get a very interesting talk from you on the subject of tourism and the economy. And one thing maybe to begin with, I think you may have picked up on certain contradictory vibes about tourism up in a place like this, or a big tourist destination, mixed feelings about tourism. You asked me what sort. I think, you know, you've heard of the tourists going through looking at the redwood trees and getting in the way of the busy locals and that sort of stuff, you know, walking around the streets of our towns without concern for us natives. So maybe you could begin with these kind of issues about tourism, and in the process tell us what tourism is and why you write about it.
Okay, I'll try. The contradiction that you're noting is endemic wherever there is an economy that is more than a little bit dependent upon tourism. It always brings a mixed blessing. It's never universally popular because basically your industry is dealing with masses of people who aren't fully aware of the norms of the local place, and they're awkward. It's like having a bunch of children running around, and you can't really count on them to move and to do things in ways that are locally appropriate. So that becomes a problem. On the one hand, you want them to come and spend their money, and on the other hand, you prefer that they know better than to do what they're doing. There are a number of solutions to this. All of them are partial, but they all help, and it really has to do with modifying your infrastructure a little bit to make sure that, you know, if there's a particularly wonderful redwood tree that people love to see, or that you can convince them is the one that they ought to see, then, you know, you can make pullouts for them to do that, so they're not in the way. And the local people can play a role in trying to educate the tourist into what the local norms are. When you go to visit Paris in France, one of the first things you'll learn from a more seasoned tourist, or from somebody who is local, if you know them, is when you go into a grocery store, you're not supposed to handle the fruits and vegetables. It's a small thing, but in this country we do that, and in France you don't do that. And it causes a tremendous amount of friction when people are doing a simple thing like going in to try to buy a banana. So, but again, as I say, it's almost impossible not to run into somebody who will explain the local norm to you. And that's something that, again, a little bit of an educational initiative to put the word out about what is and isn't done, here in Mendocino. It can go a long way toward making life a little bit easier for everyone, the tourists and the locals.
So you write about the convergence of tourism as the convergence of the global, and I suppose in our small way up here, are we part of that convergence? And what do you mean by that? And again, maybe you could offer a little definition about tourism, what you're interested in, and why you write about it.
Yeah, at the time that I wrote The Tourist, there was absolutely nothing available about tourism in the academic literature. It's not quite true. There were three or four articles about, camping and that sort of thing, but it was really, there was nothing there. And since 1976, it has grown to be what many people say is the world's largest industry. That's a contested statement, but nobody argues that it isn't very, very large and that it is also one of the few industries that's growing substantially year to year. And so now, of course, there's a major, it's a major sort of subfield in many academic disciplines, geography of tourism, anthropology of tourism, and that sort of thing. The part that's interested me all along is not the commercial growth of it, although I acknowledge that, and it is an important part of it. But the part that's interested me has been the way in which that there's an effort to achieve a human connection between tourists and their hosts, or between tourists and places that they go to, in the case of ecotourism, and that effort to gain some kind of connection or some kind of intimacy is almost always thwarted by the local arrangements for tourists. And so it's that paradox of wanting to get in with the natives and failing to get in with the natives that seems to be to define tourism that intrigues me. It's what's going on in that sort of small contested space where the tourist comes in contact with the local. And, part of your question is, yes, that Mendocino, I would definitely, your north coast of California, I would definitely count as participating in the general globalization because, you're certainly aware of a traverse of tourists, and they're not all from the Bay Area. It is a destination. It's a destination which in principle could appear on anybody's North American itinerary, and so it's not Paris to be sure, but it certainly is in the same network or framework of possibilities that Paris is in, where you've got the entire world being circled by tourists who are carrying to and away from these destinations their cultures and their impressions. And so there is a homogenization going on through the collective movements of tourists, and Mendocino is a part of that.
Could you go back and just, I wanted to be clear on one point. You said that there was a problem, though, in terms of the of connection between the tourist and the local. Is that right? What were you suggesting there? Could, or maybe an example of it would help.
Yes, the sort of the paradigmatic example that I wrote about early on, which is still very much with us, is a phenomenon that I call staged authenticity, where there's a great deal of desire on the part of the, if you take, for example, Northern California coast, there's a type of tourist attraction that I call a work display. And these are all over the world. You know, they would be the, like a Ford assembly plant or the Steuben Glassworks in Corning, New York. And in our area, it would be fishermen's wharves and, you know, any working farm that's become a part of the agritourism. So these work displays have always been a popular part of the, you know, the set of attractions that people from afar want to see. And so if you can imagine like a fisherman's wharf, a working fisherman's wharf, as a colorful work display type of attraction, then the next stage that happens is that the pseudo fishermen's wharfs start to be built to service the needs of these tourists seeking an authentic experience. But now what you've got are devices that are like stage sets that are decorated, and they can sometimes be old fishermen's wharfs. They're no longer functioning in any kind of sense of real work. But now all they are is a tourist attraction. And that's when you start to get, you know, fishermen's nets hung on the walls of chain restaurants and, you know, glass floats on display or plastic mounted fish on the walls, this sort of thing. And so what happens is, in response to the desire of the tourist to get close to the real life of the people that they're trying to visit, you get this ersatz, stagey version of that life, which has the exact opposite effect. It blocks any sense of their being able to penetrate the inner workings of the place that they've come to. So, and this you find this everywhere on Earth, to varying degrees, this staged authenticity.
Okay. Now, another thing that you write, which is connected to that, though, is that, you know, all that said, you write that tourism sort of remains or is the only economically important, large-scale complex of secular behaviors that is driven by a positive vision of the world. So maybe you just tell us what you mean, complex of secular behaviors, and then what's positive in all of this?
Yes, the as a complex, by that I'm basically trying to distinguish it from a world religion. I've maintained all along that in many ways the global movements of tourists and the motives that drive them are similar to the kinds of functions that world religions played during their early establishment, not necessarily today, but, you know, as they sought to change the minds and the ways of thinking of people across cultural boundaries. The tourists today are doing something very similar. They're crossing cultural boundaries, being motivated by a desire to know otherness. I mean, this is what they, you know, if you sat them down on a psychiatrist's couch, this is what you would soon discover, that they want to know and to understand the other. And what they're doing is bringing their values into that equation. And I do maintain that deeply the motivation for tourism and sightseeing is a positive motivation. Now, it usually ends up with negative results. I would never want to take away from somebody their desire to go and see, you know, what's life like up the north coast of California? Or, you know, how do people do things in, you know, Highland, Guatemala? These are positive sentiments. But then the huge commercial complex that is designed to service those desires, turn it into something quite other than its, you know, the original basis for it.
Okay, and I think this is connected to it, again, looking through The Tourist in your new introduction. You seem to think that there's a concept of the whole human that is involved in your way of thinking and analyzing this. And I guess I see here in my notes, the whole human being is connected to the whole of society. Is that part of this positive aspect?
That's more of a theoretical dig at my colleagues in sociology and anthropology that have been, in my estimation, in the last 25 or 30 years, been too quick to redefine their subject, you know, the understanding of human behavior, human motivation, in much more utilitarian terms than the fields originally set out to understand the human condition in. There was, you know, the great monuments of 19th century social science. They weren't afraid to talk about what it means to be human. What are human desires? What are human motives? Today, you wouldn't find any respectable or so-called respectable sociologist or anthropologist even approaching those kinds of questions. And I'm perfectly happy to be an outlier in that regard and say that, you know, in my work, I am interested in the human condition, in a much more classical sense than what you find in kind of postmodernist theorizing.
Well, let's have a little detour here for a minute. Why is that? Why are you an outlier, as you say? What's happened to the social sciences?
Quite a lot, actually, and that, you know, that could become a fairly major detour. I just read through the titles and abstracts of what was once a vaunted sociology journal, the American Journal of Sociology, one of the two flagship journals dating all the way back into the, you know, 1930s at least. And what I found in the last 3 years, there's not been a single conceptual model or general theoretical statement published between its covers. It's all very tight modeling of market issues, of motivational issues having to do with consumerism, problems having to do with improving the efficiency of management, this sort of thing. And this is basically where the field has gotten to. I don't know quite how, because after my first appointment, I kind of left it for other climbs. But it's the kinds of questions and issues that used to appear on the pages of that particular journal and others just have disappeared completely. And it's a much more restricted, it's, you know, highly empirical. I have absolutely no objections or problem with empiricism, but the kinds of problems that it's used to address are very narrow, and they've lost sight of anything that resembles a general statement about where we are culturally, socially, and as human beings.
And as by a general statement, you mean, for example?
Well, I mean, I would only give some of the some of the things that were worked on by the classics, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Marx's work, the Durkheim studies of suicide or the division of labor. These were all landmarks. They still stand today. I mean, I haven't found any recent refutations, but the field chooses to spend its time working with what, from that perspective, would be minutiae.
This is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. This morning we're talking to Professor Dean McCannell of UC Davis, and he's the author of a number of books on the subject of tourism. We've been talking about his classic book. It's called The Tourist, published in 1976, I think, still in print. And we'll continue to talk about his writing and to talk about tourism, what it is, why we've got it, what's interesting about it. So you're trying to place, Dean, tourism into a wider spectrum of thinking and into a larger context, maybe trying to make it more human. Is that right?
Yeah, and well, it's in the larger context is very fair. On the first pages of the original Tourist, I argue that it's not just a sociological study of tourism or tourist behavior, but that I intended from the very beginning for the tourist to be my model of what modern humanity has become or is becoming. So I'm trying to read the human condition through the eyes of the tourist, for better and for worse, and basically situate it, you know, like that.
And just a hint for hopefully we'll have some readers following this discussion, but just a hint, what are we becoming then? And what does tourism tell us about that?
Excuse me, Isaac.
Sure.
Break away the cough. We are going off in several different directions at the same time, and sometimes the same people. But if you look at it from the perspective of the tourist, there's some fairly stark choices in front of the tourist. They can either actualize the goal of the tourist, which is to become a more well-rounded, broadened, sympathetic, ethical person through their contacts with cultural and geographic otherness, or alternatively, they can return home confirmed in their own superiority. People going off to exactly the same site, two different tourists going off to exactly the same site and hearing exactly the same guide spiel, can come back, you know, in those two very different modes. And so for me, the question is not so much the psychology of it. How do you, you know, get into this mode versus the other one? But what's going on commercially and socially that tries to sort you into one of those modes rather than the other? And what I basically find, in especially my later research, is that almost all of the moves that are made in the commercialization of tourism and sightseeing worldwide are designed to, you know, confirm the tourist in their own egos, and to block any kind of ethical experience in tourism and sightseeing. I don't try to lay the blame at anybody's feet if they, you know, fail to realize the potential of their tourist desires. But there is a commercialization framework that finds that it's more profitable to cater to the ego demands of the tourists and to block them from having any kind of transformative experience in their tourism.
Is there an example you could think of concretely?
The example that comes popping up in much of my work is the theme park, or Disneyland would be the alpha example, where instead of actually encountering the peoples of the world, what you do is you go on a ride, and you hear the little puppets that represent the children of the world singing "It's a Small World After All," and basically you get a Disney version of otherness, which is not that. And then what you've got is a massive expansion of that model, so that now you have entire cities like Las Vegas that are built on the notion of creating ersatz versions of other famous tourist places like Venice and Paris and New York, and now we've got two San Franciscos in Las Vegas, which are there as if you have gone to these other places. And so it's the drive within the commercialization is to block access to the kinds of experience that one might have once had.
And you also make a connection or a contrast between the tourist and the internet, and everyone's concerned about what the internet is doing and what it's doing to us. How does the internet fit into your view of global tourism? And
the argument that I start to make there, I have not completed it yet, but is that there was a World Wide Web of tourists before there was a World Wide Web, and that there's a great deal of mutual mirroring that's going on between the globalization of tourism and tourist experiences and the web, so that they have kind of an interesting reflective relationship on one another, and I think we can learn about each of them through the other one. It's an intriguing kind of anticipatory thing that happened with tourism. Now you've got many of the same forums that I mentioned, where you have websites that are visited, and they use the term visited, so it's a tourist term, and then they are marked up in the same way that tourist attractions are marked up, with stars or likes or thumbs up or similar kinds of apparatus to indicate levels of approval on the part of the visitors. It's an intriguing kind of mirroring that goes on between them. But there's a ton of other stuff, like the ways in which the internet has made global travel much more accessible to people, and do-it-yourself arrangements of flights and hotels and what have you. One used to either had to go through a travel agent or make up local arrangements on the spot in the past. So efficiencies have been vastly improved by it. And some have argued that the internet is doing away with local, I don't agree with this, but with local knowledge. So you have cases where there are tour guides taking people through an attraction, and then you've got the young tourists with their smartphones checking on the guide's spiel on their smartphones, and then sort of saying, "Well, that's not quite accurate because I've just discovered here that what you just said is not quite true. This is the other way that people have talked about this," so that you have a kind of a smart-ass tourist thing that comes up where the internet is used against the local person. in terms of expertise. I think that all that that would have to do is to drive the level of expertise that's needed on the part of local people into a finer grain than has been achieved on the internet. There's plenty of stuff that local people know and can share that isn't out there, and that would be my way of, you know, countering that that particular observation. But anyway, it is to me, it's a fascinating a potential parallel development.
Okay, thank you. And I thought maybe we should shift gears a bit now, head for your newest book. I think you'd like to talk about that. Say this is, it's called The Ethics of Sightseeing by Dean McCannell, published by the University of California Press in Berkeley. I think I might interrupt you a bit in this part of it, because I think that there's lots here that's not so well known to myself, probably many of the listeners. So maybe if I could start with just some simple definitional things, and how does the word ethics fit into this? What's the meaning of the word ethics in the sense of an approach to sightseeing?
In the ethics of sightseeing, basically, I don't try to move the field of ethics off of its sort of standard philosophical moorings, which are interestingly much closer to the world of tourism and sightseeing than most people would immediately imagine at first blush. Because, you know, traditionally, classically, ethics has to do with is it possible to derive your, you know, human pleasure from being good, okay? And that's the bedrock foundation of ethics. And the illustration that I use in the book to try to get this across is that, you know, of course, we all know that not everything that is pleasurable is good. There's a lot that's pleasurable that, you know, is morally questionable. But how do you assure an ethical stance? And I say, in the world of medicine, for example, if a doctor goes into the medical field with the desire to help people, to actually minister to people, and that's where they derive their pleasures from, helping people, then that more or less guarantees an ethical set of practices. On the other hand, if they don't derive their pleasure from that, if they got into the field because they wanted prestige, or they're trying to make money, or any number of other reasons that might be held up, then there's no guarantee that their practice will be ethical, because they will find themselves in a situation where, you know, it might be more profitable to use less than best practices with their patients. So the original equation of what is ethical and what is, you know, good and pleasurable holds up. So I argue in The Ethics of Sightseeing is that most people would motivation for wanting to travel touristically and to see the sights is that they want to become a better person. It's an ethical, you know, originally the demand is an ethical demand. It's supposed to be broadening, supposed to be liberalizing, what have you. But then the question is, you know, does the experience actually deliver on that desire, or is it blocked? And that's what most of the book is about the blockages that are put across the path of the tourist to prevent them from having an ethical experience.
Okay, so looking at the book, I see one of the things that is interesting, and I suppose especially for those of us up here, the issue of the landscape connected to tourism. You have a chapter called Looking Through the Landscape, and you contrast that a bit to what you've, the examples that you've given this morning, Paris, San Francisco, and so forth, quite different. You say that tourists are also attracted to landscapes. You know, could you tell us a bit about what you're interested there in there?
Just on a formal grounds, you know, tourists look at practically everything. But one of the things that does intrigue, you know, large numbers of them, and this is probably the main attraction up where you are, is that they want to see the, you know, paysage or the landscape or nature, and that's not to be trifled with in terms of the power of it as an attraction, as a working on the desire of the tourist to experience it as a form of otherness. And you're right, I do devote an entire chapter to that. And the argument that I make in the chapter is that the ethical tourist cannot continue to take the landscape for granted as a sort of a peaceful place to park their anxieties. At the end of that chapter, I describe a thing that happened. I was in a faculty meeting at the day after the attacks on the World Trade Center 9/11, and I had a very very senior, very wise colleague who was describing actually going up onto the Mendocino Coast and going snorkeling and trying to get in touch with himself and with nature, and he was describing how wonderful nature was to heal his wounds, he felt completely at one with the sea and the sky and the bluff that he was lying on and what have you, and that was you know, his way of coping with the tragedy. And basically, even though I understood perfectly well what his desire was and didn't want to take away from it the solace that he sought, I argued that that's exactly the wrong way to look at the landscape, that it should never be taken for granted as given, as being the place where you assume that it's completely compliant with your desires for peace and beauty, but rather you have to recognize and to honor that you're in an interlocutory relationship with the landscape. It's helping to produce. It's helping to produce your thinking and your consciousness, and that it's also been worked by multitudes of people. There's no place on earth that's just natural, and that you have to honor the labor that's gone into it, realize that the labor that's going into it is either improving it or destroying it. It's a dynamism that I would want the ethical tourist in the landscape be aware of. So anyway, I do make a series of points about the fact that even though we all end up at peace in the landscape or as a part of the landscape, we die and go there, that we should be aware of its fragility and its dialogic qualities while we're, you know, before that happens.
So getting away from it, so it all is problematic then in that sense.
Yes, precisely. That's a very nice way of summing it up. Yeah.
Right. Well, I took that from you, Dean. This is KZYX. Our program is Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. We're very happy to talk to Professor Dean McCannell, who's talking with us about his work on the subject of tourism. Very interesting ways of thinking about it we're hearing here this morning, and we've just been starting to talk about his newest book, The Ethics of Sightseeing, by Professor Dean McCannell, published by the University of California Press. So the landscape, Dean, and I found the book also interesting because of the introduction of a whole number of concepts, ideas, and so forth from reasonably modern psychology that are involved in your understanding of ethics and sightseeing. How did you come to think in those terms?
Well, I've always, thank you, for noting that. I do claim at the beginning of the book that if there's any theoretical scandal in the book, it's because I believe that the most recent developments of psychoanalysis, particularly Lacanian psychoanalysis, as represented by some of the more advanced thinkers in the human sciences today, can be synthesized with general cultural concerns and with the classical findings of the early 20th, late 19th century social theorists. So basically I'm trying to bridge between what's going on right now in psychoanalytic theory and what was going on a while back in the classics that I mentioned earlier. And yes, the notion of the idea that runs through the book is the notion of the symbolic or the symbolic order. And I maintain in The Tourist and in The Ethics of Sightseeing that tourist attractions are part of the symbolic glue that holds humanity together. And it's fairly easy to work that out. I have an example in one of the earlier prefaces to The Tourist of a mother who takes her son up and shows him. I'm getting a shoe shine in O'Hare Airport, and the mother grabs her son out of the stream of thousands of people that are passing by, and it's like a 5-year-old boy, and brings him up and shows him there's a young black guy shining my shoes, and she says to the son, "Look, there's a man. He's working. He's shining shoes." And I was delighted that it was sort of stupid, but I was delighted that it happened to me because it was an elementary example of a work display and the marking of a very, very small scale tourist attraction in the way that it was done. She's the guide, the kid is the tourist, and I'm the guy, and I and my shoes are the attraction. And I make the claim that these moments where this sort of symbolic object is set between two people, the mother and the son, I say that that's our cultural DNA, that those instances, because it's there where the son starts to learn the notable things that the world is made of, and he's learning them through the eyes of his mother. And he's not only learning that, something about, I don't know what her intention was, some people have to work for a living, manual labor still exists, black people work with their hands. I don't know what she was trying, the point she was trying to make. It's not terribly important. The child will eventually know that point from that and other things that she does with him. And he doesn't just know the things that the world is made of that way. He also knows the way his mother is made. And then he also knows the way he is made either similarly to or different from his mother. And so here in the tourist attraction, in the tour guide, in the tourist, you have basically the elementary structures of the construction of reality. I used the shoe shine as my example, but we have the great attractions, the Great Wall, the pyramids, the Teotihuacan, the Eiffel Towers. We have all of those that are there between all of us, not just the intimate scenario that I just described. So yes, I believe that the symbolic order, as discussed by, you know, recent theoreticians of psychoanalysis, figures very heavily in my studies of tourism.
I think we might get a sort of mixed response in terms of following you here. When I thought about it, I said, "What's Jacques Lacan doing outside of the graduate seminar, and out here with a bunch of tourists?" But tell us about what is interesting to you as a social scientist about a psychiatrist, Jacques Lacan. How did he get involved here?
Well, you know, my wife Juliette Flower McCandle and I were students in Paris. I immediately postdoctorally, she immediately predoctorally in 1968, which was the, you know, period of great political and intellectual ferment. And so we were, you know, privileged to be, you know, at the feet of what eventually became the great masters of, you know, post-structural theory, Lacan and Roland Barthes, and, you know, Sartre was still running around and what have you. So, and for us, you know, given that we were there then and what was going on at that time, all of this was fairly normal academic discourse. When we came back to the United States, we were quite surprised to discover that everything that we went through in Paris in 68 and later in 70, 71, when we lived there, didn't arrive in the United States for about another 10 or 15 years. So we were sort of out of it for a while, and then suddenly right in the middle of it. But I've never been interested in psychoanalysis for anything other than the way that it might help me to understand the structures and organizations and motivations that I'm studying, you know, here in the case of tourists. I should mention I have studied things other than tourism, but found psychoanalysis also valuable in these other pursuits. So the question that I would put to anything that I learned from Jacques Lacan or others is it a helpful tool for understanding the tourist? And I think the little vignette that I just gave you about the shoe shine would be illustrative of that. You know, Lacan tells us that the symbolic is what mediates between human subjectivity and the real. So as soon as I define tourist attractions as essential components of the symbolic, that puts me into a dialogue with psychoanalytic theory.
And not accidentally, by the way, apologies for pigeonholing you. As they say, it's a problem we have with interviews where we only have a limited amount of time, and I should probably apologize to all the guests for possibly implying that they are only interested in one thing. But back to Lacan, so apologies, please. But
sure,
back
no
to
problem.
Lacan, and listeners would want to look up Dean McCandle and find a whole array of interests. But so Lacan, not so accidentally, and here we think of livening things up a bit. He says, you quote him as saying that the desire to be someplace else, and I includes tourism, I suppose, the desire to be someplace else is about as strong as the sex drive. What's that about?
Well, you know, Lacan was very aphoristic in the way that he taught and in many of his pronouncements. And he threw things like that out in a simply to be provocative. Now, this is not to say he didn't believe what he was saying. You know, when he says something like that, the desire to be someplace else is that strong a psychic drive, you know, then that causes me, as a as someone who was once at least an anthropologist, sociologist, to say, that's, you know, I've always been curious about the reason why human, you know, our ancestors actually populated every part of the globe except for the Antarctica, you know, before the invention of agriculture. You know, why didn't they just sort of cluster in a nice warm place like around the Mediterranean, which they very well might have done? But they didn't. They just kept moving and moving and moving, and they eventually moved, you know, in, you know, they were found absolutely everywhere on Earth. And then I, you know, having noted that being, you know, an ethnological fact, then I come back to Lacan and say, you know, he probably had something there in the way that he threw that out.
Okay, and as people get on in time and they start hearing the phrase, see it before you die, is that connected?
Yeah, actually, I regard this notion of the bucket list as being probably one of the most unethical you know, things that has occurred within the framework of modern tourism. If there is anything that you know sort of responds to the commercialization of tourism, that's it. The notion that you're simply going through the motions of travel is to me, you know, some almost horrifying that you would want to go someplace just because it's on a list of places that somebody told you to go to. All of this strikes me as being, you know, highly questionable in terms of its motivation. I would actually hold that up as exemplary of, you know, way close to the unethical pole of possible motivations for travel. The French author Stendhal had for me what I consider to be the most ethical reason, and a very simple and straightforward. Is the reason for being a tourist is to have something new to say. And it doesn't, you know, when you say it, it doesn't sound like much, but it's incredibly profound. Certainly you don't find the people that are just checking off items on a bucket list having anything new to say. Or if they do, more power to them. It means that a transformative experience along the way.
Okay, Dean, before we stop, and we have a few minutes left, I would also wanted to ask you about, to say a word about your life as a teacher and a scholar. Sometimes we do that at the beginning of the program. We're doing it now toward the end. I'm curious if could you tell the listeners how you got interested in your subjects, and maybe thinking about your subjects, I wonder, maybe listeners are not exactly clear of even, you know, what your department is, environmental design. Maybe you could tell us a bit about teaching and environmental design and what you find interesting about the students today and how you're trying to help them.
Okay. Yes, it's a complex thing. I was an undergraduate in anthropology in the old Berkeley Anthro Department. Kroeber died the week that I arrived, unfortunately. And then I went on at Cornell. I was a graduate student in the field of rural sociology, because even though I loved anthropology and loved reading classical ethnography, I thought there was something slightly suspect about the idea of studying so-called primitive peoples at the same time that they were being sort of wiped off the face of the earth by modernization. And I thought that if I got into rural sociology, I could end up in some of the same field study areas without necessarily having to wrestle with my conscience about the propriety of studying primitives and trying to pretend that they were still primitive, which was what anthropologists at the time were doing, even though they had, you know, been largely transformed. And so I was sent to the field in Puerto Rico in the Caribbean to do some field work halfway through graduate school, and I was studying the effect of new technologies on farming practices. And at the time that I was there, I noticed that they were building high-rise hotels on the beaches in Puerto Rico, and I started to ask myself, I wonder what's going to influence the lives of these people, these local people, more. Will it be the new technologies that they develop, or will it be, or that they select, or will it be the arrival of those tourists? And I thought it's going to be the arrival of the tourists, and I decided when I got back to Cornell, I would go to the library and find out about what, you know, kinds of impacts that had. And I discovered then that nothing had been written on the subject. And so that's when I decided to get to go into the study of tourism, because it was simply something I thought I could see was going to become very important, but it just wasn't studied at all at the time. And so that was the beginning there. I originally taught in the sociology department at Temple University in Philadelphia and enjoyed that very much. But after coming to the University of California, I basically have had my career in programs and departments that are not a part of the traditional curriculum. And that's probably because my approach and the subjects that I choose to study are not a part of the regular curriculum. So I was in applied behavioral sciences, which was very politically active. Basically, we taught community organizers in the 70s and 80s. And enjoyed that very much. And when his position started to shift away, try to become more professional in his approach, so-called, I left there and went into environmental design and became the person in environmental design that studied sort of the human side of the effects of different design strategies. And there's a great deal of respectable work in that area being done all around the world today. People like Michael Sorkin, architect in New York, did a really fine book called The Variations on a Theme Park, sort of on the negative impacts of urban design for tourism. And so that's the area that I've gone into. And I very much, have always enjoyed my teaching at every level, and I hope vice versa. And have had the pleasure of working with, hundreds, maybe thousands of young people who've gone on to excellent careers.
Well, I'm sure they've had that pleasure many times over in return. Dean, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us here at KZYX this morning. And for listeners, if you just turned in, I wanted to remind you that the program is talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. This morning we've had the pleasure of talking with Professor Dean McCannell of the University of California, Davis, and we've been spending most of the hour talking about two very interesting books that he has produced. The first one, toward the beginning of his career, called The Tourist, A New Theory of the Leisure Class. And the second is most recent, The Ethics of Sightseeing. That's by Dean McCannell, University of California Press. So many thanks again, Dean. I look forward to talking to you soon. And thanks again, listeners. We'll be back here next week at the same time. Good morning.
Thank you, Cal. Yeah, it's been fun.